I'm Bob Crawford. I'm here with Dr. Ben Sawyer. Ben, how was your show last night? You had a comedy show.
Yes, my comedy game show, Perfect Timing. It was we've been doing it for 3 years now. We're just starting into our fourth year. We have done it at multiple venues. We've done it at East Room. We've done it at Zanies Nashville for 2 years. And we just moved to Third Coast Comedy Club. And shout out to those guys. Last night's show was the most fun show I have ever done with it. Everybody was great. My friends and great comics, Laura Peake and Josh Wagner, won it. And I woke up this morning very, very happy. My cousin came in town. He's stationed at Fort Knox now. So I had some family there. Really great crowd. Yeah, Bob, you brought up something that I'm really pumped about. But it was awesome. If you're ever in Nashville and you want to come have a good time, we do it monthly at Third Coast Comedy Club. And you know, I've never mentioned this before, but if you ever want to come see any of my dates, see any of my shows, I have a website, sawyercomedy.com, where all of my shows are listed. I'm in the region. I'll be out in LA this summer for about a month, so I'll be doing some shows out there. So come see me do comedy and see if it's the same person. I have two different Twitter accounts, but you know.
my wife and I had a belated birthday where we both had a getaway night at a hotel, and we wound up watching parts one and two of Judd Apatow's Gary Shandling documentary that came out recently. And it's a beautiful, 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 you could tell it was a labor of love for Judd. Gary took Judd under his wing when he first started in the comedy and writing business. And it gives you a great insight into that time period of stand-up comedy in the 80s and the 90s. And I was thinking about you when I was watching it. How dark your soul must be.
Oh, yeah. My wife and I were talking about this and explaining it to my cousin James. And it was like, the reason I will probably never be the most successful stand-up comic is I'm just too well-adjusted. Like, I'm just too sincerely happy about everything.
Well, this week, Ian Scotta, our producer, and I, you know, Ian, we've got Ian sitting on the bench. You know what I'm saying? You and I, we host these shows, but we've got this talented young man sitting on the bench, ready to go. If something happens to one of us, he can just jump in and fill in for us as host. And Ben, you had family come in town. You had your comedy show. You know, it was a tight, it was a last minute interview. And Ian jumped off the bench, put on his shorts, and he got in the game.
Yeah, just so you guys know, Ian doesn't usually wear any pants at all. So we had him put on shorts for this interview.
That's right.
That's how you know he cares, if he's wearing pants.
Yes. And I think he was wearing his cup as well, just in case, you never know. So we spoke with John Sedgwick, who is an author and journalist, about his new book, Blood Moon, an American epic of war and splendor in the Cherokee Nation. It comes out this coming Tuesday. And the publisher, Simon & Schuster, was kind enough to send us a copy about a month ago. It was kind of sitting on my nightstand for weeks, and I kept looking at it, and it was calling to me, but I was reading other things. I picked it up a few days ago, didn't have to get too many pages in to realize how great this book is and how it just pulled me in. And I learned so much, even in the initial 40 pages, about the Cherokee Nation and the history of the Cherokee Nation and the history of Native Americans in the United States, that I knew we had to have him on the show as soon as possible.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I couldn't be there, but I'm glad you could arrange it. This story, especially in early America, one of the things I'll say in my classes, and it sounds inflammatory, but it's actually an easy argument to make, and it's an unfortunate thing. But the founders, and particularly by the second generation of America's leaders, you know, the United States is a white project in their minds. It is a white supremacist country. And I mean that in the sense that that is who is prioritized. And if you are natives, you know, the story of the United States that we often tell, not everyone is included. And we have to be honest about that. The American experiment and the American project has always been a work in progress. But at this time, This project, which is very racially defined, is being built around them in their homes and increasingly comes to encroach upon them. And we oftentimes think of Native Americans as being acted upon. In other words, the outsiders define their actions. But what Sedgwick does is gives them agency, tells their story, and looks at the Cherokee history as part of their own actions.
You know, John Sedgwick, you know, this is an incredible history, and it focuses on these two characters, John Ross and the Ridge, and they're both Cherokees, but they have this deep bond of friendship that ultimately becomes a rivalry. And it's great how Sedgwick works from the macro to the micro of this story. John Sedgwick he's not a historian. He's a journalist. And we see this trend here of journalists writing these great historical accounts. Like you were telling me that Ron Chernow, he's a journalist, correct?
Right.
What is it about having a journalism background that equips you to write a serious historical book?
Well, I think the difference between an academic historian and a journalist is that journalists are always thinking about how to engage the public. They're always thinking about how to make something appealing to bring people in to deliver the information they have. The beauty about history is that with your own hard work outside of a university, outside of an academic setting, you can actually learn the skill set that it takes to be a good historian. And so when the journalists take it upon themselves to master that skill set, do the incredibly laborious work of gathering sources, they oftentimes, because of their training as people who engage with the public, are able to write something and craft that information into something that's more appealing. I think it's beautiful. Some of the best books have been written on history recently have been written by journalists. Like you say, Chernow's Grant biography blew my mind. I think it should be, for those of us in the academy, a challenge to step up and actually start thinking about how to, even if in our own work we are satisfied engaging the academy, when we train our students, we should encourage them and push them to think about how do you deliver this information to the outside world. Perhaps even think about taking journalism classes or other classes that really make you take that next step, which is hard, of taking this information that is interesting oftentimes to a small group of people and figuring out a way to deliver that in a way that's valuable to everyone.
So if you're an undergrad, maybe your major is history, maybe your minor should be journalism.
Yeah. And anything, you know, anything that gives you that wider skill set. You know, Bob, whenever we started this podcast, I was so excited because it was an opportunity for me to take my skill set and you to take your skill set and to combine them together into something that delivered it to a wider audience. I remember thinking, being worried whenever we started this podcast, would my peers at the university see that what we were doing was meaningful, or would they see it as, you know, dumbing things down? And I have found that in every count, my peers in the university have liked this and supported this project and had kind words to say. So I know sometimes I think as academics, we're worried, will people look at us differently if we try to branch out and really try to hit the wider audience? And for anyone who has that worry, I would say don't worry about it. Let's push that direction. Let's bring history to people.
Yeah, I think it's important actually now more than ever. In this moment, we talk about this populist moment. It's important for academics to branch out, to get away from the academy a little bit, to engage the wider world, because so they don't get pigeonholed or stereotyped.
Right. And I think that's not to say there is a wonderful value in producing academic work. Oftentimes that's what produces the sources that allows people to then write works like these that are so good.
There absolutely is value in the academic world. There's no doubt there's value in it, but these academics need to breathe the oxygen.
Absolutely.
Outside
and my
of the
recommendation
academy.
And the thing that I've thought for a long stronger. Time is the American university is under attack. It has been for a long time. I mean, right now in Tennessee, the things that are going on, this FOCUS Act they just passed, which strips authority from a lot from the faculty and passes it to these outside boards, these boards of trustees that are business people that have never worked a day in their life in the university. I think one of the ways that we inside the university should act proactively is to bypass that. Let's show people around us what we do is valuable, and let's engage with them. And I think that as a challenge to my fellow academics and a challenge to myself, I could do it better. It's something we should be thinking about. If we want to defend the university and what's great about it, we should think about proving to people outside of our classrooms and outside of our colleagues. We should start thinking about showing them why their tax dollars are going towards something good. And it is. Those dollars are going to something good if we do it right. The night wraps round me like a blanket tight,
gets inside your seat and kills. Ramzur Records is pleased to announce the release of the Ruin Brothers debut album, All My Shades of Blue, produced by Rick Rubin. Download All My Shades of Blue on June 1st, or get your vinyl via Ramzor Records on June 22nd. Learn more by visiting ramzorrecords.com.
John Sedgwick, welcome to The Road to Now.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Your new book, Blood Moon, An American Epic of War and Splendor in the Cherokee Nation, comes out on Tuesday officially. And we're very excited to have you so soon. Actually, this will air on Monday. The book will come out the next day. We hope everybody will download it or go out to their local fine book retailer and pick it up in store. I found this book, I picked it up late and I could not put it down. And so we kind of rushed to get you on the show. But what I found so fascinating is this book is essentially about two monumental figures in the Cherokee Nation. They were best of friends, and then they became bitter rivals. But what you do so masterfully in this book, in the beginning of the book, is you give us a history of the Cherokee Nation. And there was so much about Native American history that I did not know before I read this book. So could you maybe start out by telling our listeners about that history of the Cherokee Nation?
The thing that you have to know about American Indians is basically this, and honestly, I came into this so cold that it took me a while to realize it also, and that is that Native Americans in the 1600s could be divided roughly into two camps, and they're extremely distinct. On the west, you have the nomadic bands, like the Apache, the Iroquois. These are the Plains Indians. The Apache and Pawnee and so forth. And then on the eastern side, you have something that what are called the Woodlands Indians. They could not be more different. On the west, these were roaming bands in pursuit of buffalo that they lived off of. They never created settlements. They were always on the go. And on the east, you had settlers that were not that different from the early Europeans who came to create villages. These were village settlements that were there more or less permanently and followed a kind of common arrangement of a council house, some small hut dwellings, usually by the water. And in case of the Cherokee, they always liked a particular view. I found this really endearing. They liked to have it by the water with low hills past the water and then higher mountains beyond.
I live in North Carolina, so I was fascinated to learn about Hernando de Soto and his move into the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Exactly. De Soto comes along in the middle of the 16th century, 1539, I think. It comes crashing through from Florida. He's one of these nasty Spanish conquistadors that doesn't care about anything except gold. And he was bent on pulling out as much gold from the hills of the eastern, what became the eastern United States, as he possibly could, and cared about nothing else. And that when he came in, he found a lot of, you know, Native Americans there, which he either conscripted to be basically his bearers and slaves, or horrifyingly, he would just burn them if they literally throw them onto a bonfire if they weren't helpful to him.
And you write in your book that the Cherokees were not recorders of history.
Yes, they were a timeless people. For one thing, they never had a written language until 1821, much later. So they, not writing anything down means that you have to keep all the history in your head. Well, it's kind of like the Greeks with Homer, that maybe there were some epics that were written, but that they never, or that were recited, you know, by a fire, by a shaman or someone. But that one of the things that happens if there's no written language is that you can't, that knowledge doesn't expand, it doesn't accrue. People can't add things to it in order to expand the sum of knowledge. It remains kind of this nugget that is passed along from one generation to the next by these shaman who were the sort of the keeper of what amounted to the historical record, but was really the mythic record. And that, as I say, didn't progress, and it wasn't added to by these extraordinarily significant events like De Soto. It didn't figure in some way.
So if you could introduce us to John Ross and the Ridge.
Love to. They're extraordinary men, and I had such a good time thinking about them and writing about them. They couldn't have been more contrasting. They showed the sort of breadth of the Cherokee people, because they represented pretty much both ends of it. The Ridge, born in 1771, called the Ridge for he who walks on mountaintops. Who would not want a name like that? He was born on the Hiwassee River in eastern Tennessee, extremely secluded, and is now part of the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Association, or whatever it is, administration. And so that it doesn't look now the way it did then. It was a winding river. With a small settlement, and he was raised in the traditional Cherokee way, which is to say that he experienced on puberty the most grueling coming-of-age ritual that I can imagine, whereby he was at roughly 12, maybe 13, asked to stand on a slab of rock naked in front of everybody, while an old warrior took a fox's bone that had been whittled down to four pinpoint pricker tips that this warrior then scraped over every inch of the Ridge's body. And each of these pinpoints plunged into his skin about somewhere between a quarter and a half an inch, so that it raised blood wherever it went. It must have been excruciating. And these were long swipes. They went from one wrist over his shoulder, across his shoulders, down the other arm, and so forth, all over his body. He must have been a river of blood by the time he was done. But that was the ceremony by which a Cherokee became a Cherokee warrior, hardened, enduring, and tough as nails. This was, so that was the background of the Ridge. He went on to fight in the various wars against the settlers. His first kill was by a spear. He jammed a spear into one of the members of the militia that were marauding about from the white side. And if you can picture a spearing death, there's hardly anything more intimate. You jam this thing into somebody's chest, and then you're inches away from him while his life flees from his body, and is and then you have to yank the spear out. It's just is horrendous. Anyway, so that was the ridge. And he became first a hunter, then a warrior, as I say, in these wars. And then he went off to fight with Jackson in the War of 1812 against the Creeks and distinguished himself in battle. He was about 20 years older than this other man, John Ross, who was the son and grandson of the most prominent Scottish traders of the time. And he was born not in Tennessee, but in Alabama, along a river called the Coosa, in a town called Turkeytown. And that was a commercial center. It wasn't anything close to where the Ridge had grown up. It was basically a little trading village where there was a good deal of prosperity. That Ross, unlike the Ridge, was raised as basically a little Scottish boy. He wore a nankeen suit, which was a nice little sort of going to church outfit. All the other full blood Cherokee were running around naked. He was dressed up like a little prince, and he actually rose to speak no Cherokee at all. He was basically a traitor himself for years, but that he was revered within the Cherokee for the very reason that because he didn't speak Cherokee, they regarded him something like a holy man or something. It was closer to the way that the Arabs saw Lawrence of Arabia, if you remember that movie. That he was revered and kind of mystified as or made into an almost mythical character because they didn't know who he was. Same thing with John Ross. His Cherokee followers couldn't literally understand what he was saying, but they knew that he would be a wonderful representative of theirs in Washington, where the real power lay. And that he was, because he was white, he was 5'6", he wore the English style clothes, he actually literally wore a stovepipe hat, he wore leather shoes, he would not have been caught dead in any kind of warrior garb. He never was known to kill anyone, never went into battle, never even hunted in the woods. He was basically like me, if you can imagine that, about as white as a person could be. He was, however, the longtime principal chief of the Cherokee. He was their president for 40 years. The Ridge had been with him under Jackson in the war, although the Ridge alone had fought. The Ross was simply a bureaucrat, sort of back at headquarters. But the two of them allied to form this government that I just described. It was tripartite. It was had the Supreme Court that I mentioned, and it was their personal invention.
Could you describe exactly how large the Cherokee Nation was at this time? Because you mentioned John Ross is born in Alabama and the Ridge was born in Tennessee. If you could also talk about, you have a person named John Ross. Why is he named John Ross? That sounds more like an Anglo name.
Totally. He was on his grandfather's side. He was a MacDonald. The Scots and the Cherokee had this one point in common, which is they're both literally clannish. The Scots have their clans. The Cherokee have theirs. There were seven clans for the Cherokee, and that was like your extended family. Same thing for the Scots. The Scots had come to America in an enterprising way. They saw that there were furs to be gathered and sold. There was essentially money to be made as traders, and so they infiltrated Cherokee society starting around 1700. Ross was a product of that. He was one of the, he was essentially Scottish. But he was not alone in this. The thing that's complicated about the Cherokee is that they were not all the same by any means. It really depended how much of the white blood had gotten into an individual Cherokee to determine just how quote unquote Cherokee he was. Many of the Cherokee, like Ross, were absolutely white as paper. The other Cherokee, like the Ridge, were copper skinned, and there was every gradation in between, and there was every sense of divided loyalty in between. That the Ross, speaking no Cherokee, as I said, he would read English poetry, he would read Scottish newspapers. That was his orientation. The Ridge actually couldn't read, couldn't speak English, and so that he was much more oriented towards traditional Cherokee rituals and myths. And that would those were the two extremes, and that it was amazing that the two of them could ally for even a brief time to create a common government as they did.
La Cosecha Coffee Roasters provides fresh roasted coffee grown in a sustainable manner where the farmer is given a fair price, which means the coffee goes straight from the harvest to your cup. The best part? You can get 10% off your next purchase by using the promo code RTN1010 at checkout. Visit lacosecha.com or follow the links at theroadtonow.com.
I want to piggyback on something you asked, Ian. Ian asked how large was the Cherokee Nation. So let me set this up. Reading in your book, it starts out where at one point there's 10,000 Cherokee on 125,000 square miles. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, you can picture the Cherokee, the original Cherokee lands. If you can. Think of Tennessee, that was kind of at the epicenter of it, and then extended north through all of Kentucky, and then south into Georgia, west into Alabama, east into the Carolinas. And it became, if you picture a fried egg, that at its extent of this fried egg, that it covered what you said, 125,000 square miles. That's, you know, like a tenth of the entire United States. Big area for 10,000 people. It slowly contracted to the yolk of that egg. And so that at the time that I'm writing about in the 18th century, the middle of latter part of the 18th century, that the lands had contracted to Tennessee, that all of Kentucky was ceded to a white organization called the Transylvania Society. That took it for just a bunch of rifles, basically, and that the rest of the land had been ceded. That's with a C, C-E-D-E-D. It's sort of one stretch of land at a time, and it's so that over time there was less and less land for the Cherokee. But you have to remember that there were very few Cherokee, and there were an increasing number of whites. The pressure on their borders was tremendous.
What was it about those two characters that made you want to write this book? Was it more of a story of friendship turning into rivalry, or was it more about the contrast of these two men?
Yes. You know, that was just an extraordinary and surprising discovery on my part that really this started at the end of the story for me, because I learned something that I hadn't known, and I think few people know, which is the 30,000 Native Americans fought in the Civil War. Somewhere around 15 tribes participated. And only one tribe, however, came in onto the Civil War on both sides. That there was a faction of the Cherokee who fought for the Union, another faction that fought for the Confederacy, and they fought each other. Why was that, I wondered? How curious. Yes. Well, it turned out that those two factions were directly descended from this ideological dispute that rose up between these two men who were so extremely different. And if you think about it, the Civil War in the 1860s, this Trail of Tears of 1838, the creation of the government in 1827, that's a long period of time for this dispute to fester. And I thought, wow, what a powerful conflict that must have been. And I want to know more about that. So that's when I attracted back to these men. The, John Ross is written about the rich never is. And that dispute, which is kind of like the core element of Cherokee history for the period that I'm talking about, has never been written about from both sides. It's always told as a story of John Ross versus Andrew Jackson, the Cherokee versus this monolithic, all-powerful the federal government. Well, it wasn't that. It was that was definitely a part of it. But a key ingredient was the internal dispute by the Cherokee in the face of this onslaught. And that internal dispute, I think, had much more to say about what happened to the Cherokee than Andrew Jackson did.
Can you, I don't want to give away the store here. I want people to go buy the book, but can you give us one scene, tell us one scene of either friendship or conflict between the Ridge and John Ross?
A point of conflict. One of the things that's interesting about this story is that Ross, unlike the Ridge, Ross was not trained in the warrior culture, and he was not a physical man. He did not resolve things with his fists, certainly didn't resolve things with a gun. He was a talker, and he was a rhetorician. He was not the Ridge, by contrast, was a very physical man who resolved things with his hands. And I can tell you one extraordinary moment that reflects very much on the Ridge's character and shows how different he was from somebody like Ross, who wore a cravat and a top hat and styled himself as a statesman. And this has to do with this amazing struggle that the Cherokee had with a deeply evil man named Doublehead. You got to like a name like Doublehead. Doublehead was not as big as he comes across in the stories. He was probably a good deal smaller than the Ridge, but he was an extraordinarily powerful and diabolical person who had a habit not just of killing people, but of eating their brains once he'd done that. It was nothing for him to pitch a small child onto a bonfire or something like that. He was a real horror. And that on top of that, he was somebody who had betrayed the Cherokee by taking land that he was never supposed to take from the federal government for his own purposes. And that he was demoralizing everyone because he actually had a gunboat that he would ride on up and down the Tennessee River, just scaring the crap out of everyone and intimidating them so much that they didn't dare rise up to oppose him. But one person did, and that was the Red. And so he, with a colleague named Saunders, decided that Doublehead had to go for the good of the nation. And that was, it was like rising up against Hitler or something. I mean, it was something that if you lose, you're dead. And so they realized, though, that for the good of the nation, this is something that had to happen. And they laid in wait one night for Doublehead to return from a ball play event, which is something that was sort of the center of Cherokee life. And extraordinarily, at that event, there was some Indian was so outraged by what Doublehead had done that he actually brought a tomahawk down on the thumb of Doublehead while he was leaving the ball play event. Doublehead just reached for his gun, shot the guy in the head, let him drop to the side of his horse, and carried on as if nothing was amiss, even though his right thumb was sort of dangling off of his hand. He just wraps it in a cloth, goes to have a drink at the local tavern, and that's where that was a matter of ritual for him, and that's where the Ridge and this man Saunders were likely to find him. So there he was, and that night, and the Ridge snuck up to his table, blew out the candle that was the only light, and then shot this double head in the head. And then he and Saunders go over to the next town and wait to see how things are shaking out. Is everybody going to rise up with Doublehead to defend him and then come for Saunders and the Ridge? Or are they going to be so relieved that that Doublehead is dead, that they're going to treat Saunders and the Ridge as conquering heroes? Well, it's neither. It turns out that that Doublehead was not killed by this bullet. It had actually passed through both cheeks. It had gone through his open mouth sideways and not killed him, but blood had spilled down all down his front. Well, that was horrifying. But then what was worse was they couldn't find where Doublehead had gone, and they weren't sure what he was doing to take his revenge, until they discovered a bloody trail from the tavern that led up some stairs to a second floor, what amounted to an apartment. And there they were pretty sure that Doublehead was inside. They wait there at the top of the stairs, wondering what to do. And they weren't sure whether they should dash in. Was Doublehead ready for them? Was he injured and therefore going to be utterly vulnerable? What's going to happen? And they decided that what they should do is just simply burst in. They each had guns and start firing. Well, these were in the days before revolvers, so that they had one shot each, and the Ridge and Saunders come blasting in. But of course, and there they discover that Doublehead sort of slumped over in a chair on the far end of the room. But as soon as these two men come in, he rises up to his full height and comes charging towards them. Both bullets miss, but he embraces the Ridge and grabs him in this kind of bear hug and starts wrestling with him, and Saunders trying to kick him, stomp on him, whatever it is, and Saunders still has one blast of his gun left, and he shoots him in the right hip. And then when the Doublehead recoils, pulling back from the Ridge that he's embraced in this bloody way, then Saunders grabs his own tomahawk and brings it crashing down on the Doublehead's forehead, and it plunges so far into his skull that once Doublehead is lying on the floor with this tomahawk in him, both men have to put their feet to his shoulders and the top of his head in order to pry it loose. Blood is everywhere. And then, of course, they're worried now that the townspeople are going to be outraged. But instead, they come into the room, all of the local Cherokee. They see that Doublehead is dead, that the Ridge and Saunders have killed him. They turn to the Ridge and decide that he is going to be their leader now. And he was.
It's fascinating, John. You've written another book about two characters in conflict, two historical characters that had great conflict with one another. You wrote a book about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. Are there any similarities in their dynamic that you found between the Ridge and John Ross?
Yes, and they're quite unexpected. One of them is that, in American political life, there really are two ideological poles, and that was true at the time of the founders, and it's true today. That on one side lies Alexander Hamilton, the great figure of the establishment, the one who believes in an almost imperial federal power. And then on the other hand, you have Jefferson, who is the man who believes in a dispersed power. He's sort of a states' rights guy. He believes in agrarian society, is very suspicious of manufacturing interests. Well, Burr, of course, oscillates between between those two positions. And one of the reasons that Hamilton is so distressed with him is that he's never sure which way Burr is going to go. And he fears Burr ultimately as a demagogue who is going to go in any direction that he needs to in order to secure power. Well, that is the framework, actually, in which John Ross and the Ridge are operating. Neither man is Burr, but together they become a kind of Hamilton and Jefferson. The comparison is not exact, but the point is that John Ross put his faith in the common people. He was backed by the full bloods, meaning the Cherokee who had always been Cherokee and were nothing but Cherokee and still followed the traditional rituals in the way the farmers might have in Jefferson's time, that they were these timeless people. The Ridge, by contrast, appealed to the more aspiring class of mixed bloods, the ones who had some Scottish blood or Irish blood in them, and that they were more attuned to capitalist ways and believed more that they should aspire to greater heights of property owning and wealth accruing. And they were the ones who were more likely to hold slaves, because as indications of their status and prosperity. So in a sense, John Ross is the Jefferson of the two, in that Jefferson himself was a gentleman farmer. He wasn't a real farmer. John Ross was certainly not a full blood, but he identified with the full bloods. Hamilton was an immigrant and hardly an establishment character by birth, so was the Ridge, hardly a member of the upper class, but he, as a full-blood Cherokee warrior. But he aspired to that, and he identified with that. And that in an important way, the division between John Ross and the Ridge wasn't so much in terms of their temperament or background as it was in terms of their class aspiration. And that, as I say, that the Ridge identified with the aspiring class and John Ross with the sort of timeless class, the ones who wanted to keep things as they were.
So, John, thank you so much for joining us on the show. But before we let you go, could you also tell us what got you involved in history and journalism? In other words, what inspired you to be in the profession that you're in today?
What a great question, and I wish I could have a great answer to answer it. To take the second question first, I'm a very curious person, and I say that in both meanings of the term. I'm an unusual guy in that I stay home all day long. I never go anywhere. I burrow in. I'm sitting where I am now, which is in my office talking to you with nobody around me. I never go to meetings. I don't commute. I stay home and do my work. I'm the most isolated, individualistic person that you can imagine. I do not go with the herd. I don't have an office. I don't have a proper job. I don't have a paycheck, and I don't have a boss. So I go wherever my whim and curiosity take me. So that's the other part of the curious business, is that things just suddenly make me curious. And one of the tests, I think, of a good project for me is when my curiosity leads me to another to a deeper depth and a deeper understanding of a subject that makes me more curious still. There is a way that I go deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole, and I'm just really, I can't tell you, just fascinated and want to go deeper still until I feel that I kind of get it. And then I take this material and take this understanding and I slap it down on the page and present it as a book to someone like you. That's been true of me, both in my book writing. This is book number 13 for me. I have many collaborations, but 7 or 8 now, books of my own. And also in my long journalism career before this, I used to write a lot for GQ, and Newsweek and The Atlantic. And I just always wanted to go wherever my curiosity would take me. And it took me to always different places. I mean, so few of my books, if any of them, really overlap. I mean, lately I've been writing a lot of history, but the history is always different history and different segments, different topics. You know, as you pointed out, the Hamilton book, the Hamilton Burr book, the War of Two, the Federalist period concentrated largely in New York and Washington. This is about the Cherokee, as we've said, in the Southeast, and then Oklahoma, totally different people, obviously, from the whites of the federal government. Before that, I wrote a book about my family history that took me pretty much around New England exclusively, and was my own private line kind of into history. But then in my journalism, you know, the topics were always different. I wrote about estrogen for Self magazine. I wrote about whether George Bush Sr. was a traitor to his class. I wrote about Mike Tyson. I wrote about concrete for The Atlantic. I mean, I never did anything twice because I really couldn't bear to. My curiosity was satisfied.
So John, I just want to ask you, why do journalists make such good historical writers? I mean, like, because if you look at like Ron Chernow, I think he was a journalist, you know, you came from that background. I mean, and they're writing some of the best historical profiles, historical books that come out today. What make journalists such good historians?
Well, it's kind of you to say. I think that journalists are storytellers. They're interested in narrative. They're interested in topics that people can get in a way that's not especially academic, but it's emotionally engaging. The journalists are very conscious of the fact that readers can always skip past their story or not pick up that issue. More academically inclined historians tend to believe that whatever they write is an assignment for somebody else, and they're going to have to read it, whether it's fun or not. We journalists realize that readers have options and that we have to work very hard to keep their attention and their interest and do it by, frankly, arousing the passions of telling stories, of making sure that this is emotional and not just intellectual, of making these characters come alive on the page, of using sort of novelistic techniques like point of view and suspense and vivid characterizations and a sense of and scene setting, so that you can kind of place yourself in these stories and not just hear about it in a more abstract way as properly trained academics tend to do.
It was funny, Bob and I were talking before the interview, and we both thought this would make for an excellent movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, me too. I mean, if there is a movie, I'll be the first one in line to see it. I do think that it's very promising, and my film agent has pitched it to Hollywood as the Hatfields and McCoys of Native Americans in the middle of the 19th century, which really does capture it in a nice, tight, elevator pitch sort of way, because it builds in the inherent conflict, the wildness, and the outback qualities, the sense that you don't really know why these people are at each other's throats, and it's incredibly dramatic, everything that these Native Americans do. But one of the things that I really valued as a writer was that, you know, you're always told as a writer to show and not tell. Well, the Cherokee are the same way, and that if they don't like you, they stick a knife in you. It's unmistakable. Whereas the whites of the Federalist period will, you know, dash off some diatribe or an angry letter, but except for Burr, they won't shoot you.
Well, and you know, and Hollywood is the same way. So
that's it. It's very dramatic. And Hollywood is exactly the same way. And it's very easy to picture this. You know, one of the difficulties, I'll be honest, with getting this onto the screen is that it's important to get as many Native American actors and ideally Cherokee actors involved as there can be. And there just aren't that many of them. And what's interesting about this story is that a lot of the Cherokee on the white end of the scale could easily be played by whites because they are white skinned. But you run into this awkward business of cultural appropriation and whether we might be sort of stealing the Cherokee's own story and having white people tell it for them. It's morally awkward. I'll be honest with that. The Cherokee have had so much taken from them. I wouldn't want to take anything more. And I hope that this is a tribute to them and that brings people to them in a way that's more understanding than it's been before.
Well, you know, John, I had the book sitting there from the publisher Senate, and I was reading other things, and I kept looking at it, and it was staring at me, and I picked it up a couple days ago, and I was like, ah, this is so good, so exciting, and I, you know, Native American history is something that I am very limited on, and I learned so much so fast. And so I said, Ian, we need to get John on the show immediately. So so thankful that you could make it and be a part of this today. And again, we can't
wait. Thank you so much. It's been really fun talking to you guys. I love your enthusiasm. And history, you know, is just so underappreciated. History is us. It's who we are. We don't understand who we are unless we know where we've come from. And this is one of those places. So thank you very much for your interest. I love you guys. I appreciate it.
Hey, we love you too. And that is why we do this show. John, have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Road to Now with your hosts, Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. We'll be sure to get Ben back next week for you guys. Until then, I want to go ahead and give a shout out to our Washingtonians on our Patreon account. If you'd like to learn more, visit theroadtonow.com to see how you can support our show. And those Washingtonians are Fig White, Jeff LeCane, Peggy Donican, Christopher Willis, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Paul Wheeler, Mary Hawking, Tanya Marsh, and Linda Timer.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.